This is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com. The debut novel by Arab aid worker Salim Haddad, entitled Guapa, is creating a buzz in literary circles as much for its subject matter as the author's skill. Haddad writes about a fictional gay Arab man named Rasa in an unnamed Arabic country undergoing an Arab Spring-style revolt. Haddad explores Rasa's trials and tribulations over the course of 24 hours, bringing into focus the multiple struggles facing the LGBT community in the Middle East. The Huffington Post called Guapa a, quote, remarkable debut novel. Salim Haddad is a writer and aid worker currently working with Safer World as a conflict and security advisor specializing in the Middle East and North Africa. Previously, he worked with Médecins Sans Frontières, Jordan University's Center for Strategic Studies, and the Overseas Development Institute. His short fiction has appeared in Project Pen and has been shortlisted for a number of prizes. He now joins us from London to discuss his new book, Guapa. Welcome to the show, Salim.
Thank you, Sonali. Thank you for having me.
Thanks so much for joining us. So first, tell us a little bit about what led to you writing a novel. This is your debut novel, so this is your first time doing this. What made you write this story?
Well, I've always wanted to write a queer Arab story. I don't really see growing up gay in the Middle East, I never really saw reflections of my own life or experiences either in Arabic culture, media, or in Western and English language culture and media. So I really wanted to put forward a story that shows an accurate perspective of one queer Arab life in the region. And I've always written nonfiction or analysis, and for something that I felt was quite complicated and that encompassed issues of class and sexuality and politics and family, fiction was really the only way that I could articulate a lot of the thoughts that I had. And so once the Arab Spring happened, I think I was inspired by the political protests and the revolutions to write something that was that compared political revolt to something around sexual liberation and trying to marry the two.
And so tell us about the protagonist of your book, Rasa. He is involved in an Arab Spring-style rebellion on the streets of this fictional Arab country, and has some of the hallmarks of what we've seen in countries like Egypt or Syria, where there might be an authoritarian president or head of state. And there's also, of course, the Islamist factions. And then ordinary people wanting to rise up. And in this context, you have an ordinary young man who happens to be gay. So his life is, you just covered a day in his life, about 24 hours in his life?
Exactly. So it's 24 hours in his life, and it starts the morning after his grandmother catches him in bed with his lover, who is from an upper class, rich, powerful family. And so it's a day of him really discovering where he stands politically with the confusing protests around him and the different political allegiances and movements that are taking place, and not really being able to fit into the different politics that are being played out, but also in terms of where he fits into this changing society and whether he sees a future for himself, an authentic future for himself in this society, both sexually and politically.
And the name of the book, Guapa, is in reference to a fictional bar that your character encounters.
Yes. So growing up in the Middle East, it was always funny to me that there
were... And where in the Middle East did you grow up, by the way?
So I was born in Kuwait City, and I left during the Gulf War. My family moved to Cyprus, and then we settled in Jordan. And my family now live between Lebanon and Dubai.
And so Guapa, tell us about that.
So Guapa it's a bit of an inside joke for me. There are so many different bars and coffee shops in the Middle East that take on Spanish names, and I don't really know why that is. But I thought it would be funny to just make reference to that and have a bar called Guapa.
And of course, the roots of Spanish and Arabic are common. I mean, there's a common root to these two languages. There actually are a lot of Spanish words with Arabic roots.
Definitely, definitely.
Okay, I'm wondering if you can read a section from your book. This is your first novel, but you can't really tell writing your book. It's beautifully written. But you've won prizes for your writing, so you're an experienced writer, both fiction and nonfiction. But taking on a novel is a huge feat. It's something that really, requires so much work. And your book is just, I enjoyed reading it tremendously. And I'm wondering if you can read a section from your book for our audience.
Absolutely, I'd love to. So this is in the early stage of the book. So this is soon after Rasa wakes up the next morning after his grandmother catches him in bed with another man. I switch over to CNN. I can't stand to look at the president's face, and I want to see how the foreign media is covering the events. The television anchor, an older woman with dyed blonde hair, has a look of concern in her eyes. The troubled nation has been experiencing upheaval since protests erupted earlier this year, and the latest development seems to confirm growing fears around the radicalization of the opposition to the president's rule. Only a few months ago, I was on that television screen, my beaming face, along with thousands of others, all crammed together, waving flags and singing victorious songs. The camera panned across our nameless faces, and we cheered back. We each had a name, a history, a life. But we were willing to forsake all of that if it meant appearing strong, united, steadfast. For that moment, we wanted to be nameless because we were one united mass against the bull we had thought was inevitable. No more hypocrisy, no more fear, no more staying put and shutting up and selling our souls to political devils for the sake of stability. After an eternity of fear and suspicion, it suddenly seemed so obvious, as if the opportunity had been staring us in the face our whole lives and all we had to do was reach out and grab it. At one point, I was interviewed by CNN, and with a smile on my face, I addressed all my friends who had left and vowed never to come back. You can all come back now. We need you to help us rebuild. We were so hopeful then, so ridiculously naive. I turn off the television and pick up my phone. The dark screen of my mobile glares back at me. Still no word from Taimur. I want to call him, just to hear his voice, even though I don't know the right words to say. Instead, I call Maj. His phone is turned off, so I send him a message. My grandmother caught me and Taimur last night. It's all a mess. Just last night we had been at Guapa, Basma, Taimur, Maj, and me. We drank beer and argued. The subject was, as always, American imperialism and the sad state of our revolution. Taimur had been so insistent that now, more than ever, the president was the only alternative. It was either that or the Islamists.
Salim Haddad reading from his debut novel, Guapa. Now, the setting for this book, as I mentioned, is the Arab Spring Revolution. Did you have any particular one in mind? We've had there were so many in the last few years. Tunisia's among the first among them. That you based this novel setting on?
Not really, no. I mean, so I grew up in Kuwait and Jordan, and I spend a lot of time in Lebanon because my father is Lebanese. And so I have a lot of experience living in those countries. And in my own work, during the Arab Spring revolutions, I w visited Yemen a lot, I visited Egypt and Libya, and I've worked a lot on Syria. And so I was very familiar with the politics of those countries, and I had lots of meetings with youth and women activists during the 4 years after the revolution. So I was writing this in the process of doing a lot of this aid work, working on transitional and peace processes and trying to bring people together. And so I just found that there was so much in common between all of these different countries, both those who have directly experienced revolution, but also those like Jordan and Lebanon, who had very similar politics, but didn't necessarily experience this intense uprising that the other countries had. And I wanted to draw on all of these similarities, in writing the story and bring in different elements from these different countries.
And in your visits to the various countries during the Arab Spring protests, did you find that gay rights was an issue, in a big way or even in a small way?
I think it did come up, but it was not seen as a priority. And I think when there were small flourishes of gay activism within the broader discourse of the revolutions, it was quickly put aside as something that was seen as not a priority at this point. When in fact, in my opinion, I think when we're talking about freedom and equality, I think we need to talk about it in a very broad sense for all people, both, you know, of different sexual orientations, genders, that sort of thing. So I didn't see it directly, but I think it's important to mention that, you know, and this is something I wanted to bring up in the book as well, is there's a huge diversity of queer lives in the region, and they've been active for many, many years, long before the Arab Spring revolutions. People have been active in a broad spectrum of work in the region. And so I think part of the book is also about recognizing that there is a life, there are queer lives that are lived in the region.
And so let's talk about that, because of course your book is, you know, it describes a life, it describes a community that we don't get much information about here in the United States. And when we hear about the Arab world, often we simply hear that society is repressive, you know, that ISIS is killing gays, and that if there are gay folks that enter the media discourse, they're victims. But can you paint a more nuanced picture of what the LGBT community in the Arab world is like, and the kinds of struggles they face, but also the triumphs, and also just the day-to-day, you know, because in many countries, and I grew up in the Middle East as well, in many countries, there is an underground scene, and it's quite vibrant, and there's the sense, even from authorities, that, you know, the sort of a don't ask, don't tell sense, right?
Absolutely. I mean, there's a huge diversity of queer experiences that I don't think I'm even aware of them all, right? Because I come with my own blends and my own, you know, community and perspective. So in no way can I even claim to speak on behalf of the diverse queer perspectives in the region. But from my own experience, I mean, there's everything from cruising places that are quite down low to, you know, huge bars and clubs in some cities in the region. And I think it does operate on a different interplay between private and public that exists in the Middle East. So it is exactly a don't ask, don't tell for the most part. But so much of it is also linked to class. And if you're from a certain class, then you are afforded more privileges and you have more power. Mm-hmm. And for me, and what I think is really important to mention, and why I felt that writing a gay novel needed to be linked to the Arab Spring protests, which were demanding justice and dignity, is that the problem in the Middle East, as far as I see it, is the lack of accountability when it comes to laws and holding people in power accountable for these laws and for protection. And so I think linking queer rights with the need for broader accountability and justice is integral.
And so I want to go back to what you said about the issue of class. And so your main character, Rasa, as you said, his boyfriend is from an upper class family. And so you have that interplay. But you mean, even if you do come from a place of a more class privilege, it doesn't necessarily protect you, right? I mean, even here in the United States, we know that having more class privilege doesn't necessarily protect you from homophobia.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. No, it doesn't protect you. But I think it gives you a bit more protection. There was a very interesting case that happened in Lebanon, I think in 2012, where there were a series of raids against gay cinemas. And there's an incident in my novel, which I think I played on that, where there was a raid on a series of cruising cinemas where men would go and cruise. And these men were usually working class men who couldn't afford to go to the bars in the more upscale neighborhoods in Beirut. And funnily enough, the raids happened after a television show shed light on these cinemas. And the host of the television show was then exposed by some gay rights activists in Lebanon to be gay, because they showed photos of him partying in a gay bar in Mykonos. And this was sort of in retaliation to him outing those cinemas. And he went public by saying that his privacy was invaded and that there's a difference between what, quote, sexual freedoms and public morality. And this to me is really the protection that people with power have, is they get to dictate what is private and what is public. So for him, what he does in Mykonos and his ability to practice his gay identity or his queer identity in Mykonos is fine because he's able to dictate that that is okay. But then what happens in Lebanon is a question of public morality. And so I think there's a very rich discussion happening in the Middle East among queer activists that touches on all of these issues.
What about the issue of family and the sort of shame that, you know, a lot of folks experience when they haven't come out to their own family members for fear of being ostracized? And of course, this is a universal story, this part of it.
Absolutely. And there's no, and it's so diverse in the Middle East, right? Like it is in the US. I mean, you have you know, depending on the person, they could come from a very conservative background or they could come from a very liberal background. In general, I think people, shame is a huge, from my own personal experience, which is really what I can speak from, shame was a big factor in regulating and policing my own behavior. And it was done not just by my family, but also by the wider community. You know, the concept of aib, which is shame, which I talk a lot about in the book, was constantly being used to police my own behavior of what is the right way to act in society and the wrong way to act. But I believe as well shame can be subverted and renegotiated. It's a malleable concept, the idea of what isn't and is shameful. And I think that comes down to a very personal relationship. From my own personal experience, I'm lucky to have a family that is quite supportive of me. But it did not come without a struggle. And that's what I tell a lot of my friends as well. It came with me having to challenge my own family's ideas of what is and isn't shameful. Mm-hmm. So, for example, instead of saying it's shameful to be gay or to have a gay son, you can subvert that to say, well, it's actually shameful to reject your son. That is a greater shame for me than what sexuality your son is. And by playing around with these concepts, you can really build a space for yourself within your community.
I'm wondering if you would allow me to take a small tangent. I understand that you're part Palestinian as well. And recently in Slate, you had an article about your grandmother, whose home was lost to Israel, to the new Jewish state. Israel is a country that considers itself a, you know, bastion of gay rights in the Middle East. At least some liberal Israelis consider themselves set apart from the Arab world because of how they espouse gay rights. How do you see that?
I think it is a very manipulated concept. This idea of what they call pinkwashing, which is Israel using or promoting a perspective that it is the only region, the only country tolerant of gay rights as an excuse to legitimize its occupation. I mean, this has been going on for years. But actually, when you dig a bit deeper, you can see the way that gay people in the West Bank and Gaza have actually been very hurt by the occupation. So, I mean, if you go back to the 80s during the First Intifada, the Israeli government actually played on the fact that queer people were marginalized in Palestinian society to use them as spies or as, you know, to pull information out of them. So they would threaten to out them to their family in order to get information. So these sorts of things, I think I would very much question whether Israel is necessarily a progressive bastion of gay rights in the region. Mm-hmm. And I would also go so far as to, and this is what I would like to do more broadly, is to broaden our idea of what queer is. Yes. So when you're a Palestinian who is born in a refugee camp in Lebanon and you are completely stateless, you have no ability to work, you have no ability to travel, you basically have no hope for the future, for your own future. That to me is a queer body. You know, that is a body that is not fitting into the wider system. When you're talking about a gay person who's living in Gaza Strip, who's just had his legs blown up by an Israeli bombardment, that is a queer body in more ways than one. And so for me, I would like to confuse the idea of what is and isn't queer, because I think it's very important to do that.
It reminds me of the refrain that feminists often did: women's rights are human rights, gay rights are human rights.
Absolutely.
Finally, you're an aid worker, and some of the stories we're seeing coming out of Syria, in particular, which is one of the most difficult places in the Middle East today to simply be a human, are the struggles of gay refugees leaving Syria or attempting to find refuge outside Syria. Is that also, as you say, a queer story?
I think the concept of refugees leaving in general is a very queer story. They become queer bodies by virtue of having to make this treacherous journey across the Mediterranean. So I was in southern Turkey a few weeks ago, and I was interviewing a lot of Syrian activists who were delivering humanitarian aid into Syria, and they were working under incredibly difficult conditions, trying to get aid into all areas in Syria, including areas besieged by Assad regime, areas where ISIS are operating. And I think often the sheer determination that a lot of these people have does not often come across in mainstream media. You know, when we're sitting in London or New York, we hear about Syria and we hear about, you know, the trauma and the violence and ISIS and Assad, but you don't often hear of these incredibly brave people that are, you know, defying all of these odds and doing amazing work on the ground. And so I think it's also very important to talk about those beautiful moments as well. Syria is a horrible crisis. It's a heartbreaking crisis, and there's been so much death and destruction, but there's also so much power and agency in the people who are there on the ground, who are still doing amazing work despite the difficulties. And I think we need to highlight those voices as well, no?
Salim, how has your novel been received, not just in the Western world, but I'm assuming that it might be released in the Arab world as well?
It is available in some Arab cities. Some bookstores have been ordering it, and I am in the process of trying to find a way to get this translated and get it in an Arabic publisher. So fingers crossed, that would be my ultimate goal. So far, the book has been out for 2 months, and I could not have been, the response could not have been more positive. I think there is such a desire to have these conversations in the Middle East. People want to talk about this. And the only emails and messages that I've been receiving from the Middle East have been incredibly positive, whether it's from, queer Arabs who felt that the novel spoke to them or their experience and felt represented for one of the first times, or whether it's from parents of queer Arabs who have said, oh my God, I finally understand what my gay son is going through. This is amazing. Thank you for giving me that perspective. It's been incredible. I've been so overwhelmed, and it's been incredibly positive.
Give out a website for your work.
So you can find a lot of my writing on salimhaddad.com.
And we'll post a link to that from our website later today. Salim, best of luck to you. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Sonali.
Salim Haddad is a writer and aid worker currently working with Safer World as a conflict and security advisor, specializing in the Middle East and North Africa. His short fiction has appeared in Project Pen and has been shortlisted for a number of prizes. And he joined us from London to discuss his new book, Guapa, a novel about a fictional gay man in an Arab country. This is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com.